power forward into the months ahead. If you haven't done so yet, visit WSLR.org. WSLR.org. See you next week.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Sarah Dennis with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, April 11th. The Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency plans to drastically cut its greenhouse gas reporting program, reducing emissions tracking from 8,000 to just 2,300 facilities, mainly in oil and gas. Experts warn this is like unplugging the vital signs monitor of a critically ill patient, as the data collected since 2010 and covering up to 90% of U.S. emissions is crucial for climate policy and global accountability. Critics say the rollback favors industry and weakens the U.S. ability to combat climate change. The Sarasota Planning Board has recommended approval for a plan to restore the historic Miramar building while constructing two 18-story condo towers behind it. Some planning board members were concerned about the developer's request to rezone the site on Palm Avenue near Main Street from downtown core, which allows for only 10-story height to downtown Bayfront. Seaward Development argues the rezoning is needed to fund the $30 million restoration of the deteriorating building. The decision now rests with the Sarasota City Commission, with some critics questioning the feasibility of the preservation and the potential long-term impacts on the area. Some of the seven Manatee County commissioners would like to overhaul the Planning Commission due to low attendance, ideological differences, and lack of district representation. Commission Chair George Cruz suggested removing all current members and allowing commissioners to appoint representatives from their districts. While some supported this idea, it lacked enough votes to pass. Other changes, like setting attendance requirements and offering paid positions, are also being discussed. The proposal will be revisited in future meetings. This has been Sarah Dennis with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, April 11th.
Program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Many thanks to all who contributed to the station and this show during the spring membership drive, as the roller coaster ride that is the Trump presidency took some stomach-churning zero-gravity drops this week. First, the Liberation Day tariffs were announced and executed with the same skill and precision as the rest of the actions this administration has become known for, by including levies on islands populated only by penguins. Markets reacted in the only way they could, by falling faster than an exploding SpaceX rocket falls to the sea. But wait, as mysteriously as they were leveled, The tariffs were paused, which prompted a rebound of markets, which administration officials are claiming was a grand plan, some kind of demonstration of achieved leverage. However, all this is missing the point of the market reaction to the pointless tariffs. The so-called smart money controlled by Wall Street money managers recognized it might be time to unload equities ahead of what will certainly become a recession. Tariffs are a tax on consumers in the imported country, where prices will increase. And speaking of increasing prices, the only country still on the tariffs list is China, who happens to make much of what this country consumes. No problem. Just build factories in the U.S. to replace all those now high-priced foreign goods. Maybe in a decade or so, if the country survives, we'll make everything we need right here in the good old U.S. of A. Too bad reality is not that simple. Stay tuned until 1:30 to hear my conversation with Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, the largest union in the state, representing more than 120,000 educators, who unpacks the impact of eliminating the Department of Education and upcoming education bills in the state legislature. But first, here's how some volunteers are rescuing important data the administration is trying to erase. In defiance of an executive order that wiped out reams of data from U.S. government websites, volunteers are reversing this act of official vandalism and ensuring open access to the censored climate, LGBTQ, and health stats. Scores of activists are working to safeguard and then make public data that they have archived for safekeeping after President Donald Trump's administration targeted gender ideology extremism and environmental policies with deletions. We're moving past the initial phase and approaching the next, ensuring that there's public access to everything that we have preserved, data scientist Jonathan Gilmore told Thomson Reuters Foundation via a video call. Gilmore belongs to the Public Environment Data Partners, a coalition of environmental justice and policy organizations committed to public access to federal environmental data. They're working along with other volunteers, environmental coders at Earth Hacks, archivists such as the Internet Archive, data consultants Fulton Ring, to build new public access tools from the purged data. Trump has gutted several federal agencies, firing tens of thousands of employees, and altered or deleted thousands of government web pages since taking office in January. First in Trump's firing line were health, climate, and LGBTQ plus data sets that fell foul of his ideology. These include stats gathered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, such as the Social Vulnerability Index and Environmental Justice Index, measures used to both quantify the health risks faced by different Americans. Among those working to restore the deleted data are former government workers and staff who were put on leave by Trump. An Environmental Protection Agency employee placed on leave helped make the new map that shows improvements in air pollution monitoring systems and upgrades of aging sewer systems made under the environmental justice grants. It's miraculous what we've been able to do, take these tools and protect them from this act of official vandalism, said the employee who requested anonymity to speak more freely. Those who are leading efforts to restore access to the missing data say they are understaffed, underfunded, and persist in their work despite risking retaliation from the Trump government, which has targeted lawyers considered hostile. There is certainly a concern of retribution from the administration, but we feel strongly we're on the right side of history here, Gilmore said. The White House did not respond to requests for comment before time of publication. Rajan Desi and Jeremy Herzog, founders of the Fulton Ring, were motivated to volunteer by reports of government censorship. This is like George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984. It made it very real for us, Desi said in a video call from New York. The duo built a new version of the government's future risk index showing the cost of climate change to U.S. communities. The administration removed the original managed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency in January. FEMA did not respond to a request for comment. The new version resurrects the dead data, but also processes it faster and better on smartphones, even fixing some of its old bugs. The aim is to arm ordinary Americans with the sort of valuable information that is currently held in private hands. A lot of this disaster data, flooding data, is used by insurance companies and financial institutions in some capacity. The only person that seems to not have any visibility into this is the average consumer who might use it to buy a house, DeSay said. Work in progress or internal tools that were not public-facing could be retrievable if the Trump administration defies federal laws on record retention, the EPA employee said. An EPA spokesperson said that it was working to implement Trump's executive orders. Canadians will find someplace else besides Florida to get warm this winter. Canadians' desire to visit the U.S. is absolutely tanking, new data suggests. President Trump's tariffs and insistence that Canada should become the 51st American state is fueling a remarkable rally around the flag effect. Canadian patriotism is skyrocketing alongside disdain for all things American throughout the Great White North. It especially matters to tourism-dependent Florida, which is among the top U.S. destinations for Canadian travelers. Advance bookings for Canada-U.S. flights in April through September are down over 70% compared to this time last year, per aviation data from the OAG. This sharp drop suggests that travelers are holding off making reservations, likely due to ongoing uncertainty surrounding the border trade dispute, writes OAG chief analyst John Grant. Airlines are also reducing trans-border capacity, a strong signal that they too are seeing or at least predicting less demand. The threat level, just a 10% drop in Canadian travel, could lead to a $2.1 billion lost in spending and 14,000 jobs cut, per the U.S. Travel Association. Carriers with flights between Tampa International Airport and Canadian cities cut seat capacities by 12% this month from what officials predicted in January, the Tampa Bay Times reported this week. Miami International Airport and Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International had even bigger reductions, per the Times. The Americans may not realize the depth and intensity of the anger up there, said Toronto resident Larry Milson, one of many Canadians who wrote to Times columnist Graham Brink back in February. I love Dunedin, but I'm not going there this year and maybe never again. The intrigue? Canadians were the target market for Visit St. Pete Clearwater's seasonal tourism campaign as the agency sought to attract visitors after hurricanes Helene and Milton. Revenue from Pinellas County's tax on hotel rooms and short-term rentals was the highest it's ever been for December and January when compared to the same months in previous years, spokesperson Jason Latimer told Axios. Collection data isn't yet available for February and March, so the full picture of whether U.S.-Canada relations are impacting local tourism revenue remains to be seen. Canadians make up about 3% of Pinellas' visitors each year, Latimer said. They account for about 2% of all visitors to the Sunshine State, per the Tourism Bureau Visit Florida. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. However symbolic, resistance is important. Hundreds of President Donald Trump's nominees for high-level positions throughout the federal government have run into a brick wall, and the lone senator behind it has no plan to relent anytime soon. During an interview with CNN host Jake Tapper, Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat from Hawaii, who is a member of both the Senate Appropriations and Foreign Relations Committees, delved into why he is expanding his hold to include more than 300 of Trump's nominees, along with several critical pieces of bipartisan legislation. The Hawaiian senator explained that his hold, which he is doing by denying unanimous consent, the process by which Senate conducts official business, is meant to apply leverage to both the administration and the Republican majority. I cannot grant them unanimous consent. I'm just objecting to that. If they want any of these nominees or these bills to receive a vote, they have to schedule a vote. But this will slow them down, Schatz said, and this is designed to lay down a marker both about the lawlessness of the Trump administration, but also about the fact that Donald Trump himself is destroying the American economy on purpose. According to Axios, Schatz's hold includes nominees to lead the Office of Personnel Management, the Inspector General for the Department of Labor, and 9 bipartisan bills that have already made it through their respective committees, including bills Schatz himself voted for in his own committees. Tapper pointed out that 2 of those bills are meant to counter activities by the terrorist group Hezbollah in Latin America and to oppose China's assault on Hong Kong's democracy. He noted that those bills seem pretty important and asked Schatz why he's blocking them. Part of what it means to do a hold is that sometimes you're going to block things that you would otherwise allow to happen, and that's the case for these. But we have to generate some leverage, Schatz responded. So, until Marco Rubio comes to the committee and testifies about what they're doing in terms of illegally eviscerating United States aid, I'm not going to allow even those bipartisan bills to move forward. We have to be willing to stand up to these folks and come up the works, even if it's politically uncomfortable to block a bill they would otherwise be for. Tapper pushed back and reminded Schatz that he called Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, a maniac during his blockade of hundreds of promotions for high-ranking military officers, which lasted for most of 2023. But Schatz noted that his denial of unanimous consent for Trump's nominees was completely different than Tuberville's hold on promoting military officers. It's a pretty important distinction between what Senator Tuberville did and what I'm doing. These are political appointees, which are always or usually subject to Senate vote. So what I'm doing is slowing them down, the Hawaiian Democrat said. What Senator Tuberville did was to prevent a 1-star admiral from becoming a 2-star admiral. These are career Department of Defense flag and general officers that were blocked. That is not the same as what I'm doing. CEOs speak up, finally. Reality of a global trade war is starting to push corporate bosses to do what they tried for months to avoid, criticize President Trump's policies. In the days after Trump announced the sweeping levies last week, chief executives stuck to privately channeling their frustrations to trade groups and lobbyists. Some hastily arranged new meetings on trade with Trump officials, sometimes receiving unsatisfying answers, executives and corporate advisors say. Now, after a 3-day market sell-off and warnings from Wall Street titans such as Bill Ackman and Jamie Dimon, more business leaders are openly voicing concern. Ken Griffith, the billionaire who runs hedge fund firm Citadel, called the tariffs a huge policy mistake at an event this week at my University of Miami, according to a report from Bloomberg. It is wrong to tell a middle-class or economically challenged family it's going to cost you 20%, 30%, 40% more for groceries, for your toaster, for a new vacuum cleaner, for a new car, Griffith said, according to the report. Even the dream of jobs coming back to America, even if the dream of jobs coming back to America plays out, that's a 20-year dream, not 20 weeks. It's not 2 years. It's decades. In the global economy, tariffs tariff is not a beautiful word, said Bagram Akaradi, CEO of the high-end fitness chain Lifetime Group Holdings, in an interview this week. You cannot apply this type of gridlock and this much friction to the world's trade. The CEO of Ethan Allen, who manufactures 75% of its furniture across North America, also suggested the president retreat from the tariff offensive. There's nothing wrong in coming down. It's not a failure, said Farouk Karawadi, CEO of the Danville, Connecticut-based furniture maker. Bridgewater Associates founder Ray Dalio said he is very concerned about the practicalities, despite agreeing that the U.S. has a problem in that it doesn't manufacture enough goods. I agree with the problem, but I'm also very concerned about the solution, the billionaire hedge fund founder said in an interview this week on CNBC. Trump's current plan will cause companies' costs to rise and revenue to fall, he added. This is going to create sand in the gears of production worldwide, he said. More CEOs will be pressed in calls with investors this week to divulge just how Trump tariffs could affect their company's operations and bottom lines as earnings season start. Walmart executives face shareholders at an Investors Day Wednesday, while Delta Airlines reports earnings the same day. Wells Fargo presents its results on Friday, followed by other big banks next week. Some of the first leaders to speak out or who have been vocal Trump supporters. Ackman, the billionaire hedge fund manager behind Pershing Square, called for a 90-day pause in the tariffs to negotiate with other companies, warning that the alternative was a self-induced economic nuclear winter. We are in the process of destroying confidence in our country as a trading partner, as a place to do business, and as a place to invest capital, Ackman wrote on a social media post on X over the weekend. Ray Cohen, a Trump-supporting CEO of the video game retailer GameStop, posted on X last week that the tariffs are turning me into a Dem. A day later, he quipped, "I can't wait for my $10,000 made in USA iPhone." GameStop is already taking a hit. Nintendo said that it would indefinitely halt U.S. pre-orders of the Nintendo Switch 2 because of new planned tariffs. Even Elon Musk, one of Trump's most influential advisors, took a swipe at the White House trade agenda. On Monday, the billionaire posted a well-known video of economist Milton Friedman touting free trade by explaining how the component parts of a pencil require complex supply chains. Anti-abortion forces in Florida are pushing their final solution, legally declaring fetuses persons. A pair of bills in the Florida legislature seeks to provide legal protections for unborn persons. The legislation also defines who is considered an unborn person in Florida. The House measure HB 1517 and its Senate companion SB 1284 would extend provisions of the personal injury laws to unborn fetuses, allowing surviving family members to seek compensation as a result of negligence. But experts say the protections to the unborn and their families are only part of the goal. The bigger implication of the bill would be its legal recognition of an unborn person. This is an express effort to say from the moment of conception, this is a human being, period, said Jay Wolfson, a professor of health policy at Stetson University. According to both the House and Senate versions of the bill, an unborn person is defined as a member of the Homo sapien species in any stage of development who is carried in the womb. Central Florida Public Media reached out for comment to the bill's sponsors, Republican Rep. Sam Greco and Republican Senator Aaron Grawl. Neither office responded. A similar bill with the same title was crafted last year, but it died in the House on the second reading shortly after a controversial ruling made by Alabama Supreme Court, which declared embryos created through in vitro fertilization should be considered children. The court ruled in favor of families seeking damages against IVF clinic after one of its patients gained entry into a cryopreservation storage area, opened a sub-freezing temperature unit, grabbed embryos, burned themselves, dropped the embryos, and destroyed them. This year's set of bills would allow survivors of the deceased parents and other family members to seek legal relief. The bill would protect mothers from wrongful action and health care providers in certain circumstances, as long as those providers are in compliance with the applicable standard of care, including care related to assisted reproductive technologies such as IVF. Wolfson thinks the bill is an attempt to follow the Alabama Supreme Court's IVF ruling. I think it's all on the same wavelength, and that wavelength is to broadcast the intention as a matter of public policy that viability begins at the moment of intention of conception, Wolfson said. The moment unfertilized embryos are stored for later use would be considered unborn because of the intention to create life. Wolfson's last concern with the bill has to do with the chilling effect it would have on families with pregnancy complications seeking more children. If they have a pregnancy where it's very high risk and they learn later that there's significant cognitive issues with the fetus, the uncertainties that places on families and on the healthcare system and on the legal system are not inconsequential, he said. The Senate version of the bill may not be moving forward in favor of the House bill, which is set to receive a second reading this week. The first lawsuit by a business challenging tariffs was filed in Florida. A Florida stationery entrepreneur has become the first to legally challenge Donald Trump's new China tariffs, claiming they were imposed illegally and threatened American small businesses. Emily Lay, a lifestyle influencer and the founder of Simplified, filed the federal lawsuit last week in Florida against Trump and his administration, arguing that the president unlawfully bypassed required procedures when he implemented the 20% tariff on Chinese imports. The legal challenge comes amid escalating global tensions, including China announcing retaliatory tariffs of 34% on all U.S. goods starting on April 10th in response to Trump's Liberation Day tariffs. Global markets have already seen trillions wiped from valuations as fears of recession mount. These unlawfully implemented tariffs cause harm to American businesses, American jobs, and American consumers, and will be the end of many American dreams, Lay wrote in a post on social media. The particular and sweeping nature of Trump's tariffs, the peculiar and sweeping nature of Trump's tariffs has raised eyebrows, with even uninhabited territories like Australia's remote Heard Island and McDonald's Islands, home to only penguins and volcanic landscapes, appear on the White House list of places facing new trade duties. Despite market turmoil and likely more lawsuits, Trump wrote on Truth Social that his economic policies will never change, telling foreign investors, "This is a great time to get rich, richer than you've ever been before." Lay's Pensacola-based company, which sells premium planners and organizational tools, argues that Trump exceeded his authority by using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act instead of traditional trade rules, which require detailed investigations before tariffs can be implemented. The lawsuit also claims Trump has not demonstrated the tariffs are necessary to address the opioid emergency he cited when imposing them in February, then doubling them in March. Supporters of the president have held that small and local companies like Simplified should go all in on using American manufacturing for their products, an idea the company maintains it has already tried without success. We pursued domestic manufacturing from the outset, Lay wrote on Instagram. Our first planters were made in the U.S. in 2012. Each unit cost $38 to make. The U.S. did not, does not yet have an infrastructure to support what we make. The lawsuit adds that the tariffs will divert money that could be used to pay salaries, fund growth, and pour into communities, and instead forces small businesses like hers to either raise prices dramatically or cut staff. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Coming up next is my interview of Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association.
I'm Lou Lorenian. I'm happy to welcome back Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, the largest labor union in the state, representing more than 120,000 educators who are united in their mission to ensure success for Florida students and public schools. How you doing today, Andrew?
I'm doing great, Lou. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, that's terrific. Haven't spoken to you in a while, but you know, a lot to talk about now. And maybe give people a little break from the stock market, you know, which is killing everybody.
Yeah.
All right, you know, the current administration and its appointed, you know, Chief Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, another secretary that was appointed by this administration that has, I don't know, as far as I can see, absolutely no qualifications to be head of the Education Department, but they contend that the DOE is basically a bureaucratic boondoggle. Cost taxpayers billions in wasted red tape. What does the DOE really do, and why is it important not only for Florida public school students, but public schools across the country?
Well, Lou, thanks for the question. I think that's the crux of the matter for so many. What does the U.S. Department of Education do? And first and simply, it enforces federal law. And so there's some federal law around the education of our children. I'll get into it in a second. But that federal law can only be enforced by the U.S. Department of Education. You know, states enforce state law, local communities, local laws. The federal government enforces federal law. And that's what the U.S. Department of Education does when it comes to education law. So what areas of law do we have at the federal level around education? Well, first and foremost, is students with special needs. We have a law called IDEA, which stands for Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. It is a federal law to ensure that students with disabilities are given the support they need to be successful. That can be students with physical disabilities. It could be students with mental disabilities. It can be students with academic learning different disabilities. And so myself, I grew up and still have dyslexia. I was diagnosed in elementary school as having dyslexia. I had what's known as an IEP, an individualized education plan. It is a plan that's written with the school and the parent involved, looking at the data around that student to make sure they're successful. I was personally helped through school and even to this day by the support I got under that law. So that is one clear area where literally millions of people across this country have been impacted by federal law, by the U.S. Department of Education. Second is the area related to what we call Title I funding. This is funding for students who live in poverty. Again, another federal law that says we must make sure we support students who live in poverty, because we know that the number one driver of the success of a student is how we handle poverty for kids who live in poverty. And so Title I programs actually have before and after school programs, enrichment programs, enhancement programs, tutoring programs, and so much more that is covered under those under Title I to make sure that students are successful. Another program you may see is students who come to this country with English as a second or other language, making sure that they're able to learn English while continuing their studies and be successful in school and in life. And there's a host of other programs as well that come from it, including at the higher ed level, Pell Grants and federal aid, all run through the U.S. Department of Education. So as you can see, Lou, it touches so many of our lives, or has touched so many of our lives, and that's why the U.S. Department of Education is really an essential part of the federal government in making sure that our country continues to prosper.
Yeah, you know, I'm just curious. I mean, I'm thinking about Title IX, and I'm thinking about civil rights enforcement too. You know, for students, isn't that something else that is covered by?
Absolutely. So, the Department of Education. Now, they haven't always dealt with the civil rights aspects of it, but they do currently deal with the civil rights aspects, making sure that no student's civil rights are denied in the pursuit of their education. And then Title IX, as you pointed out, that has a lot to do with women in sports and other areas. And so, again, making sure that women are treated and girls are treated appropriately in school so that they, too, can get the education they deserve and need. So there are a host of other programs as well, but, those are obviously some of the main ones that most people are familiar with.
Yeah, you know, and I did couldn't help but notice that there's been a lawsuit filed against the federal government and the DOE by the NAACP and the National Education Association, which I guess is the umbrella organization that the FEA is also a member of, among others, you know, for threatening the loss of funding for any institution practicing DEI initiatives, which seems to be, you know, for this administration, you know, just the worst thing ever, you know, trying to level playing fields. It's a horrible idea, right? I mean, this is like, and it's, but the way they're doing it is, against the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and some other amendments. It's unconstitutional, you know, right? I mean, just the status of that lawsuit.
Yeah, so the both our national unions have been engaged in numerous lawsuits against the administration in Washington, D.C. because of some of the acts that President Trump has initiated, some of them dealing with, as you just pointed out, DEI being taught in our schools. And I just want to be clear, because I find so often people go, oh, DEI, it's terrible. It's diversity, equity, and inclusion. We are a diverse society. So if you believe that we should be aware of how diversity strengthens and makes our community so great, then you would support the idea of making sure we have programs so that everybody understands each other in a diverse community. The idea of equity, the idea, you know, equity really is based in what we just talked about. That's what Title IX is all about, making sure that women are treated and girls are treated appropriately and equitably in our schools and in their education, among others, right? And inclusion, especially when we talked about at the beginning here, our students with special needs, making sure they're included in programs and supported in our schools. You know, this term DEI has become a trigger term, but really what we're talking about is making sure that every child who comes into our schools, which we are obligated to teach under the Florida Constitution, that every child that comes into our schools is welcomed, is supported, is seen as an individual who can be successful and who can contribute in our society. We don't believe in turning anyone away. We don't believe in shutting doors. We believe in making sure that everyone is included. So we have filed lawsuits to say that, you know, for an administration that says this should be all about state rights, how do they then say in order to get federal dollars, you must do what the federal government says? Seems to be backwards. And I'll just end this part here on this term here that I think is so important for us to understand. We all believe that the best place to decide a child's education is between the administration, staff, and teachers working with parents at the school level. Not someone sitting in an ivory tower in Tallahassee, and not someone sitting in an ivory tower in Washington, D.C., but actually at the school level, and making sure that we have the supports we need and the guardrails and guidance we need to make sure that every child gets the education they deserve and can be successful.
Yeah, and I know this is a little bit off track of our discussion about just education, because this whole DEI thing has been flipped on its head. There's all kinds of areas in United States institutions where they're trying to say that because there are DEI supports or supports for minority groups to get them just basically seen. Not quota systems, just to get them basically seen is somehow discriminatory against straight white men. So,
let me also say this. Yeah, and let me say this too. A lot of the aspects of DEI actually came from the business world, right? I mean, this idea that we now operate in a global economy, and for businesses to exceed at a higher level, we have to understand different cultures, different ethnicities. We have to understand that not everyone is the same and thinks like we do, but that there are differences of thought. There is difference of cultural beliefs and religious beliefs and so on, which actually makes the human race, in my opinion, it makes us, incredibly powerful in that way. And it's just really, when you think about it, and we get out of the politics and put the politics aside and really focus on policy and what's good policy, I think everyone would agree we have to respect each other. I think everyone would agree we have to make sure that every child who comes in our school gets the education that is appropriate for them, that they deserve and need to be successful. And it's not a cookie cutter. It is a different approach for every child. And if we're thinking in those terms, and if we're looking at it from that perspective, then we don't have any differences in thought in how we approach this. But we get into the world of politics, and it becomes a key trigger word. And then anyone hears DEI on one side of the aisle is saying, oh, it's awful. And on the other side of the aisle saying, we've got to do it. What gets lost in it is the people.
And that's exactly right. You know, any country must realize, or I think we can all agree, that any country's greatest resource is its people, all of its people. And it was pointed out, I forget who said it, but I wish I'd made it up, but pointed out that what DEI actually is and these DEI initiatives, is making sure that we get our most qualified people, no matter what they look like, no matter where they came from, no matter whether they're, a man or a woman, or just the best people. I mean, clearly, and I'm going to be a little wise guy here. When they fired C.Q. Brown, as Joint Chiefs of Staff head, and made Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of, head of the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense, I call that a DEI hire. He just got hired because he was a white guy.
Yeah.
basically, and how's that working out? But anyway, of course, as some of us, I guess, know, the Department of Education was created by Congress, and therefore it can't be canceled legally and constitutionally, by anybody but that body, and not by executive order. But the administration and its minions can do a lot of damage by firing people without cause, basically hauling out the organization, which I got to believe will affect its efficiency. Is that the plan? Ruin it and then point and say it's a terrible thing and it needs to go, and convince Congress to get rid of it? I mean, is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly what the president has decided is he's going to starve the Department of Education. He's going to divert programs and resources out of the Department of Education, programs that they oversee. And here's the thing. Let's not lose sight of the fact that the president and Elon Musk, their mission has been to cut spending on programs that most impact people. I'll point out, not all spending, just programs that impact people. And so if we think they're going to take this money and just send it down to the states and that's going to be the solution and we're streamlining stuff as they like to claim, again, I'm going to go back to only the federal government can enforce federal law, number one. And number two, I'm not buying it. Districts right now throughout Florida are trying to set their budgets for next year. And in setting their budgets for next year, they need to have an idea of what to expect. And right now, districts are in a very difficult position. They're not sure what might be coming in federal dollars. And so many schools rely on those dollars directly coming down to the school district without any short stopping, without any diversion of those dollars at the state level. And so that could be problematic for school districts who are already cash strapped here in the state of Florida.
Yeah. You know, I just want to interrupt for a second. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Andrew Spahr, who is president of the Florida Education Association. You know, while I haven't heard this yet, but is this, you know, work they're doing in Washington another attempt by some, you know, and kind of a thing we should be familiar with here in Florida, you know, to gut public schools for private schools, you know, so that the people that run the private schools can all of a sudden have access to all that fat education money?
Yeah, I've long believed that that's the trajectory of those who are trying to undermine public education. I mean, I don't know that there's any other explanation for what we've seen here in Florida, and now some are trying to do federally across this country, right? But this notion that supposedly vouchers and charter schools were going to be the solution, they were going to improve student learning, they were going to create competition. I mean, that we've all heard that, right? But what does the data actually show us? It shows us that this experiment in Florida has failed. We've been doing it for 27 years now at this point. And in the 27 years since vouchers and charters started in Florida, Florida students are actually performing worse now than they did back then, or certainly no better. And what we continue to hear from people who push that, which, by the way, is not necessarily lawmakers. It's people behind the scenes who are pushing this notion of we've got to do more of that. They're saying we should double down on this failed policy. No one in their right mind would look at data and say, it's not working. Let's do more of it. But that's what we're hearing from some of these folks. And the question is why? Why? Because they make money off of it, right? That's what this is ultimately about. It's not vouchers and charters are about money. They're not about kids. And there's a lot of evidence to back that statement up. First and foremost, in Florida, there's a book that's thousands and thousands of pages thick that governs public schools. There's pretty much nothing that governs vouchers and homeschooling and very little, a much smaller number of pages than what you see for public schools governing charter schools. So that's number one. Number two, you constantly hear about how we have to make kids in the public schools take tests and jump through hoops, and we have to evaluate teachers based on those student test scores, and everything is about high-stakes testing. But then you don't have to do that in the voucher schools or with homeschooling. There's rules on what you can do with money. There's 20 different laws that govern how we pay teachers in public schools, but nothing for charter schools or vouchers or homeschooling, obviously, because there aren't teachers there. But, you know, there's none there's no laws that regard that. And that's just one of it, many, many examples of to the inconsistencies of this. And if it were about kids and about their learning, then there would be uniform rules around how state dollars or federal dollars are spent on kids, rather than saying, hey, if you're a public school, you must jump through the 5 million hoops we create, and if you're not, you don't have to do anything. That's not about kids learning. That's about money. That's about trying to incentivize programs to get kids out of the public schools into these private schools that are completely unaccountable, run by corporations, and driven by profit. And that's something we should all be concerned about because, again, the data shows our schools that our students are doing worse today than they were 27 years ago when we did this. And the number one factor in all of this was that the educators and parents were taken out of the process and money was starting to drive the decision.
Yeah, and I think it's important to, point out for those who aren't aware, we aren't talking about chicken feed. Last year, $4 billion was handed out in vouchers. And
that's right.
And a lot of the people that received those, what is it, like $7,000 or $8,000 per pupil per year, a lot of those people were already sending their kids to private schools, and they just got a break on it.
And let me just say this, and the private schools raised their tuition. So that was $8,000, and there's a lot of private schools out there who said to parents who were already sending their kids, over 85% of those vouchers last year, new vouchers to the program, went to kids already enrolled in private schools, already at those private schools, and they told the parents, listen, we're going to give you a $3,000 or $4,000 discount, and then they raised the tuition by, $4,000 or $5,000 to offset it. So who profited in that? It was the private schools, and that was a common theme that we saw repeated over and over and over again last year. And I'll tell you another thing that happened this year, which again raises a lot of red flags. There are over 22,000 students who are in our public schools. They were counted as being in our public schools, and public schools, so everyone knows, we have to count what we call butts in seats. We have to count every child that's in attendance when we do these counts for the funding for our schools twice a year in October and February. 22,000 students, over 22,000 students, were counted in the public school system, but were also reported as receiving vouchers. And that just doesn't seem right. Something seems amiss there. We know they're in the public schools because we had to count their body. So what does that mean? Does it mean that they may have applied for a voucher, decided not to take it, but the voucher company is still trying to claim them to get that money? Is it some kind of partial enrollment where they're in the public schools, but they're also doing something with a private school? I mean, the list can go on and on, or is it straight up someone's lying, right? And we just don't know, and the state doesn't know, and they never really figured it out. But school districts throughout the state, in some cases, lost millions of dollars because of the vouchers this year over what they were expecting, because no one could figure out what really happened here. And again, I think that's somewhat intentional.
One of the sort of shady, sketchy things, that I hadn't heard about. But one thing that always occurred to me, and I wish somebody would look into it, is people who claim that they homeschool their kids and they get the voucher. All right. So I can go to I can apply for the voucher and say, well, I'm going to homeschool my kid. Give me $8,000, and then, homeschooling could be 10 minutes of looking at a globe for a day and then going to Disney World because you got the money now.
And that's the key. Now, I just want to clarify to all the listeners, the money doesn't just automatically go to a family. If they say, I'm homeschooling my kid, they don't just get $8,000. They have to submit for what they call educational expenses, and then they get reimbursed in that. But the problem with that has been is there's no guidelines, again, on what's an educational expense. So we know for a fact that parents were able to submit annual passes to Disney and say that was an educational expense. They were reimbursing it. They were able to buy a brand new big screen TV for the house and get reimbursed for that. So there's just no guardrails on it, and therefore anything can happen. There's no accountability. And again, what we know in public schools is that kids often return to the public schools if they have left the public schools. And when they return to the public schools, they're often behind where their classmates are in the time that they were gone. And so there's just too many instances of problems not to have some boundaries in place to ensure that, A, taxpayer money is being spent appropriately, and, two, that kids are getting the education they deserve and need. And for whatever reason, there's nothing in the private school sector or homeschooling, and there's a little bit in the charter schools, but there's not a lot there that really ensures any of that is happening and that kids are being taken care of in that sense. And, you know, you hear all the time, well, the parents will know, the parents will know. The parents know in public schools, majority of kids go to public schools, and yet we have dollars being diverted away and programs being eliminated, class size going up, all of those challenges that parents are seeing, not to mention the worst teacher and staff shortage we've ever seen in Florida continues.
Yeah, that was you know, something else I wanted to bring up. But, you know, on that note, Andrew Spahr, you know, I really need to thank you for, you know, making time for me this week, because I'm sure you're, like, really busy because this is a legislative session. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the bills, but, you know, I'm kind of running out of time. But if you want to quickly comment on this bill, you know, that on your website is entitled, you know, Attacks on Worker Freedom, that is going to yet again make it harder for people to be in a union and other things that are pretty awful.
Let me just do a quick legislative wrap up here, you know, speed round if I can. Number one, those bills, it doesn't look like they're going to move. They haven't been moving through the process. We've worked with legislators, including the top leadership in the House and Senate, to make sure they don't. We saw a great bill pass out of the Senate last week, Senate Bill 166. It's now going to the House. We hope they'll act on it. It reduces the reliance on high-stake testing for students and for teachers. It adds some job stability for teachers. It's really got a lot of great things in it. Some things we don't like, but overall, a really good bill. There's movement now to fix the teacher salary issue here in Florida. Again, I mentioned 20 laws that interfere with teacher pay. That's now starting to move, and we want to get that through the process. And so the biggest challenge still out there is the budget, and that's where we need everyone's help on. Call your legislator, call your House member, your senator, and tell them that they need to make sure that our public schools get the funding they need and the flexibility they need.
Great. You know, it just actually going back to that restoring local decision making, you know, I know it did get some press earlier, and it sort of caught my attention, you know, that, you know, kids didn't need to have to, you know, pass an Algebra 1 test to graduate, you know, and the implication was they didn't need to know that. Well, no, that's not true. You know, they do need to prove that they know what they know. It just isn't based on one test, right?
That's correct.
You know, and that's why you guys are supporting it. So, all right.
Yeah, teachers invented tests, but we invented tests for the purpose of knowing whether or not our kids are learning the content, not whether or not they should graduate from high school based on one day.
Yeah, or whether or not the teacher should be paid a fair wage.
Yeah, exactly.
<You know. laughs> Great. Okay, once again, I want to thank you, Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, for making time for us today. On your way out, tell my listeners how they can learn more about what you guys are up to and what they ought to know about what's going on in education in Florida.
Absolutely. You can follow us on any social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky. We're everywhere. I'm also on TikTok if anyone's on TikTok. And then go to our website, feaweb.org, feaweb.org, and you can find out a lot more information there as well. And, Lou, as always, I appreciate you having me.
And I thank you.
President Donald Trump is reportedly planning on holding a 4-mile-long military parade on June 14th, his 79th birthday, and the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary. The Washington City paper reported that the massive parade would flow from Arlington, Virginia, and into Washington, D.C. It is unclear whether the event would feature heavy military equipment, such as missile launchers or planes, as Trump once desired during his first term. Trump has long wanted a showy display of military might to descend on the nation's capital. After he won his first term, Trump wasted no time asking staff at the Pentagon to send him photos of military tactical vehicles he could use for his inaugural parade. Email showed the Pentagon was hesitant to comply, citing concerns over exorbitant costs. In the end, he didn't get his parade, but there was a 20-plane flyover. Neither the White House nor the Pentagon immediately responded to the Huffington Post's request for comment this week. During Trump's first term, he was inspired to plan a parade after attending a Bastille Day event in Paris, where France's jets, tanks, and other heavy military equipment were on display. Former U.S. military officials noted that the extensive military parades, especially with tanks rolling down U.S. roads, are not really in the American, quote, style. That's just not our style. You know how powerful you are. You don't have to pretend, retired Air Force General Michael Hayden told CNN in 2018. A source involved with preparation for Trump's first inaugural told HuffPost in 2018 that behind the scenes, military officials were worried a miles-long military parade would too closely resemble the military parades of North Korea or Russia. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton.